One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Well, do you feel better having listened to all of us? Hopefully you have, particularly if you're suffering pain, because that was a bespoke piece of music specifically connected to help actually manage pain and so on, supported by Nurofen in, of course, Pain Awareness Month. We know, certainly, as far as the Midweek Drive is concerned, we've had fabulous music by the likes of Pamela Suman, by Tallulah Randall, by a whole heap of other fine folk, including Sandra North, who all take away the pain. But this is scientific. This is clearly designed to actually work through that. And so we're delighted to actually welcome the two souls responsible for creating all of us, the amazingly talented musician and composer, indeed, of all of us, Anatole. How are you, Anatole?
Hey, good.
Excellent. And we've also got the equally amazing and wonderful psychological researcher from the University College Dublin. That's Dr. Claire Howlin. How are you, Claire?
I'm great. Thank you, Alex.
Claire, can we come to you first? Because this is something which, again, most folk tend to have an intuitive feel that, you know, music. It soothes the savage beast and so on. Bob Marley, of course, quoted as saying, one good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain. So just talk us through the psychological rationales in terms of why a good tune can actually alleviate so much of our pent-up anxieties and frustrations and indeed irritations in life.
Well, we know that pain is actually really heavily influenced by a lot of psychological factors, your different levels of attention and different levels of emotion. So when we listen to music, music also plays around a lot with our attention and our emotion. So it actually distracts the brain completely from the things that are causing us pain. And then the saliency of the music can actually redirect pain signals away from the painful stimulus because it's actually been taken up by the music stimulus. And then we know that actually when you listen to your favorite piece of music, it has the ability to give you a big burst of dopamine in your neural reward network, which can lead to a lot of natural opioids and that are natural pain relievers in your neural reward network.
And the key word there, of course, Claire, is it's natural. I mean, in an era where people are so concerned, quite rightly so, about big pharma and pharmaceutical ways of actually, oh, just prescribe some drugs and that'll actually help from that point of view. Well, yeah, it might actually sort of have a short-term impact, but this is surely something which can actually help not only manage pain, but as you said, in the production of dopamine, really be a big asset to well-being in general, I would have thought.
Yeah, like it actually really demonstrates that you can actually reduce levels of pain intensity and pain unpleasantness by listening to this track is what we found. And it does actually help to provide a more holistic approach to health and well-being, where we're no longer thinking about health as just an absence of illness or an absence of symptoms. But what we're really trying to do is bring people to a much more positive wellness space where people actually feel good about it as well. And they have positive emotions or emotions that they like to connect with.
Okay, Anatole, we'll return to your good self now in terms of the musician and composer, of course, for all of us. We've heard, initially I thought, oh, we've got little children's voices coming in there. It sort of builds and then it works in all sorts of ways. Is this the first time you've worked with a fully qualified psychologist to actually say, yeah, this is going to actually sort of really be a trip?
Yeah, I can't say many people have done this sort of thing before. So it was really interesting to be offered this opportunity to work together. And so at first I had no idea what I was going to do. So we actually had some discussions at first and was kind of like briefed on the whole idea. And then we kind of talked about what we would be able to measure in the experiment and this concept of empirical aesthetics. So how can you kind of create an emotion or an idea? So we wanted to go with a sense of wonder. So that really kickstarted the composition aspect for me. And so once I had like all the info, I was able to just like create a track that I wanted to create, but kind of towards a certain goal.
I mean, it's really interesting in terms of the creation process. I mentioned one of our regular contributors from New York, of course, Pamela Sue Mann, who together with her husband, Jerry Leonard, do some awesome stuff across the base. But I don't think even they've actually considered the whole notion of the scientific approach to working it out. I mean, were there any moments where you thought, oh, this is too cold and calculating? It's all like, you know, music is not like numbers. You can't sort of quantify in that system.
Surprisingly not, actually. I think if you kind of know what you're doing, you kind of just... it kind of influences the way you make certain decisions. And I think limitations are the main driver of creativity. So for me, it just meant that I created in a different way. And it influences like my sound selection and like harmonic and rhythmic choices. But like we made a conscious choice that we didn't want a piece that wasn't authentic. And if someone's listening in a study, they can tell when something's not made, I don't know, with heart in it, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Claire, do you play any musical instruments yourself?
Not so much, not really. No, I play a little bit of piano, but no, the musician skills definitely lie with Anatole.
So was this a role in which you were more the director / producer and were you actually saying, ah, oh, that's the piece I want? Were you kind of instructing or were you guiding or were you just saying, well, let's just test this out? Just talk to us a bit about the process.
So what I did basically, as Jonathan mentioned there's a lot of research in empirical aesthetics that really try to use scientific methods to understand attention and emotional responses to music. So I drew from a lot of previous research that demonstrates that feelings of nostalgia can be really powerful in music engagement experiences, that elements of surprise are really important to maintain your engagement, And then looking at the structure of music, kind of from more classical pieces, where composers tend to use those approaches quite a lot to sustain your engagement, but then bringing in percussion elements that will be more familiar to younger and more contemporary listeners as well. So trying to like create a piece of music that had different elements in it for different groups, that would be familiar enough that you would be able to find it accessible and engaging, but enough new and surprising elements in it as well, that it was actually interesting as well, that it wasn't too predictable, that it would just become boring, or background or white noise. So obviously the concepts are fine, but you need a very skilled musician to actually implement this and maintain the creative integrity of the piece, which we, you know, we're, that it's kind of, I think why the project worked so well was because we were able to bring the two different skill sets together and co-collaborate on the piece.
Every note, beat and sound designed to elicit a sense of wonder, empowerment and indeed inspiring mental strength to help dissociate from pain. It's fair to say that the universe of music from the romantic classical composers, the Beethovens, the Mozarts and so on, through the more discordant, disharmonious, some might say, work of Philip Glass and so on, mirrors the kind of experience you've got from heavy metal right the way through to popular culture as well, and even country music these days. Anatole, from your own point of view, were there any particular sort of biases that you actually had? And again, just share with us your own particular musical tastes.
Oh, my own musical tastes. I think it might be a little bit of a surprise at the moment. I'm actually going through a bit of a heavy metal phase. And so right. I listen to a lot of black metal, which if you listen to that track, you would not pick up on. But yeah. I think that's like when you are as involved with music as I am, you kind of maybe looking for new things to listen to. So that's just something I'm going through.
So not really a Johann Sebastian Bach follower from that point of view.
No, but I grew up playing in orchestras and stuff. And so I have an appreciation for that, and we'll like listen to it from time to time. But yeah.
If there are any Bach fans listening to this, the actual structure of the music that Jonathan has created very much aligns with a classical composed piece. It's completely different than a standard piece of pop music. And not completely different, but it's just got that longer arc that somebody who does listen to classical music will appreciate, goes over a much longer frame of time.
Extraordinary. As we said, it was supported by Neurofen. Are there any plans, Claire, to kind of produce a sequel? Is this a case of, again, you're going to feel that the Howlin' Anatole or the Howlin' Baker relationship will be as successful as Gilbert and O'Sullivan, or even, as I say, the wonders of McCartney and Lennon?
Who knows? I would never say never. We still have a little bit of data to analyse on this project as well. So we're very excited to kind of see what other insights we're going to develop from it. And then we'll just see how this actually plays out in the real world. And hopefully, yeah, definitely keep in touch and think of new ways to try and improve how we develop these different sounds.
And finally, where can people actually go to find out more information and indeed listen to the track itself? I mean, obviously, we'll play it again. You can play this podcast back and so on. But if you're looking to find out more and appreciate more, where would you point them to?
You can go find information about the study and the piece at neurofentuneuppain.co.uk, but you can also find the Spotify playlist, Tune Up Pain, on Spotify.
And for the listener who might just a wee bit confused about, is it Anatole? Is it Jonathan? Is it Mr. Baker? is there an alter ego there?
Yeah, so the artist's name is Anatole. I am Jonathan Baker from Sydney, Australia.
Excellent. So just wanted to clarify that, because you never know what could happen. For the moment, it's been awesome connecting with both of you from that point of view. Jonathan and Claire, huge thanks. And hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future. Take care now.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I think it was Richard Ashcroft and The Verve who once had a hit with The Drugs Don't Work. Maybe actually it's a case of you shouldn't really try and avoid the drugs wherever possible, because it does appear that we have a prescription opioid crisis on our hands as far as Britain's concerned. And to talk about this and share with us some of her findings about a recent Q&S survey, it's the fabulously wonderful Dr. Ellie Cannon. How are you, Ellie?
I'm well, thank you. Hello.
Excellent. Now, you really addressing this whole issue about the accidental misuse of prescription opioid painkillers, something which many people are being prescribed after they've had an injury or surgery and so on. But it does seem as though there's a dark side to the prescription of these, which is not good at all.
That's right. I mean, opioid painkillers are very useful medications. People will be familiar with codeine, morphine, tramadol, the type of things doctors like myself prescribe for people with chronic pain, or if people are having had an operation, still in pain, that type of thing. But as with any medication, there are risks as well as benefits. And particularly with opioids, there is a risk of overdose unintentionally. So people taking too many tablets because they become tolerant or because they have too much pain and the medication can be addictive. And sadly, we do hear about deaths every year as a result of people taking too many prescribed opioids.
It's fascinating to find out about OIRD, or opioid-induced respiratory depression. Mm. That's, again, something else that is... It's something which, again, we've heard about over the years, but perhaps didn't realise it was such a great problem. Is it just a case of we do need to be very much aware that there are good things that could come out of these pharmaceutical products, but ultimately it's not worthwhile becoming connected with them so they become a dependency?
Mm. Yes, absolutely. And I would say that's the case for many medications, but particularly sleeping tablets, painkillers, even painkillers you can buy over the counter can have opioids in them and can become addictive. And we hear of lots of cases, both myself in my GP surgery, as well as in the media, you hear of cases of people who started off very innocently using painkillers for pain, for an injury or after an accident, and really before they know it, after months, are using huge amounts of over-the-counter medications such as codeine or prescription medications. Often people are waiting for a long time for treatment such as pain clinic or physiotherapy or even an operation. Of course, that situation has been worsened by the pandemic. And so people can end up unwittingly addicted to medication and unwittingly at risk of respiratory problems from opioids, which are one of the known side effects, the breathing complications.
Over 4,500 drug-related deaths are recorded in England and Wales by the ONS over the last year. A shocking statistic, as we said at the start of the piece. For people who are listening to this and are clearly concerned and will be perhaps a little bit anxious about the whole process, what advice would you provide, Ellie?
Well, if somebody is sort of nervous about the amount of opioid that they might be taking or the painkillers, try and have a chat to the GP. I know, obviously, we've spoken a lot recently about difficulty with access to GP surgeries, but GPs are open, so they're only a phone call away. A lot of GP surgeries have pharmacists within their surgery now, so you can speak to the practice pharmacist or your local pharmacist. And have a chat to them about how much you're using, why you're using so much. We've been encouraging people through the pandemic to start to monitor themselves and see what their own sort of health and vital signs are looking like. We talked a lot about oxygen monitoring throughout COVID, and that's something that people can do if they're taking opioids, check oxygen levels. That is what the Masimo safety net alert is for, to check oxygen levels, to check heart rate, to look for signs of respiratory problems. And really, it's just a case of being aware that this can be an issue, even if you are taking medication prescribed by your doctor.
And we were talking earlier about ways in which music can actually be there as an additional sort of way of managing pain and indeed eliminating pain, with psychologists analysing aspects as well. Would you encourage folk to seek out alternative or complementary aspects to maybe sort of weigh in against this this notion of don't just expect it all to be solved by a pill?
Always. I would always advocate that. There's always sort of more than one answer, and particularly pain is multifaceted. It has huge physical elements, psychological elements, emotional elements. Anybody who has a chronic pain condition like arthritis or endometriosis will tell you that their pain is worse, their physical pain is worse when emotionally they feel worse, when there is stress at work or stress in the home. So if we are relaxing because we're listening to music or because we're with people who make us laugh, all of those things are incredibly important aspects of pain management, and can be a part of treatment alongside pills and other things. And I would always advocate for those non-pharmaceutical ideas.
And where would you suggest people should go to, Ellie, if they wish to find out further details about the ONS survey or indeed the areas we've been talking about today?
So have a look at Massimo Safety Net Alert online, and the idea of taking control of your own health and checking what's going on with your breathing, either because you're on opioids or for any other reason. All the survey and information is there.
Ellie, an absolute delight, as we knew it would be. Dr. Ellie Cannon, huge thanks. Stay well, be healthy, and keep saving lives.
Thank you.
Now, I often say to my students at Lincoln, parents are very difficult to bring into the world, but at the same time, we still have to acknowledge that they are vital in terms of the whole experience. It's also a case of you take a double take when you realise that ace actress extraordinaire Cherie Murphy has actually got a child who's off to university. I don't believe this. I mean, she can't be chronologically gifted enough to actually be in that sort of position, but she is. And we're delighted to actually welcome Cherie now to actually share with us how she's going to strategically ensure that her child still contains the sort of joy of being able to stay in touch, phone home as a Generation Z person, Generation Z, of course, if you're not American. We're delighted to welcome, of course, Cherie Murphy. How are you, Cherie?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, great to see you on board. It seems like only yesterday you were just getting married to Harry Kewell. What's going on here? It's just the world.
I know. I feel like I've blinked and now I've got kids that are leaving home. I can't bear it. It's all happening so quickly.
Exactly. And I suppose that's the key thing. I mean, I'm, a couple of weeks' time, I'll be welcoming the new freshers to the University of Lincoln. We'll be saying that, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, you'll feel as though it's just gone by. You'll be graduating at the cathedral after that. But there is that sense that when you take that big step away and you go, suddenly do you lose touch, and different people have different ways of working through it. So what's your strategy, Cherie? How are you going to sort of ensure that actually contact is maintained?
Oh, well, so obviously I'm super excited for my daughter, Ruby. We dropped her at her halls last Friday. I was a blubbering mess, but she was quite fine. She's like ready to flee the nest and ready to start her new adventure, which I'm super excited for her. But as any parent, I'm a terrible worrier. And although I don't want to bombard her with calls and if she's not calling me back and stuff like that, I know I've got to kind of just let her go. But I also want to make it easy for her that if she wants to get in touch, you know, she's not run low of data and stuff like that, and she can't afford to top up. I just kind of want to know that there are those things in place that, you know, if she does need me, I'm there at the end of the phone. So it's just those little things, because you want them to be super independent. And that's what we've kind of, you know, I've taught her that she's got to now stand on her own two feet. But there's still nothing quite like your mother's advice or your dad's advice or any family member's advice, actually. So, yeah, it's just making sure that we can have that contact always.
I mean, I'm of the generation where, in order to actually connect with one's parents, because I was literally, I went to London University, had to go around, leave the actual college, find one of those red telephone boxes and put the various sort of things in from that point of view. So it's strange. But you still actually want to have, at least on a weekly basis, you'd actually sort of just say, OK, well, let's work through that. And I suppose one of the things about the mobile facility is that it is easy on the one hand to stay in touch, although equally there is that balance between letting go and ensuring that people will be able to develop and grow themselves.
Absolutely. So Sky Mobile have conducted this survey, and they asked lots of students and parents lots of different things. And 94% of parents actually expect their children to check in on a weekly basis. Now, that's staggeringly high. And I think, so I don't think that's unreasonable. I think a weekly check-in is definitely great. And we're so lucky now that, you know, at the touch of a button, we can actually see our kids, you know, we can Skype them or, you know, FaceTime them and stuff like that. So there's no excuse, you know, sometimes, especially if children are staying away from home and they're not going to come back till Christmas, it would be quite nice to see that my daughter does look okay and she's looking after herself. So we're lucky to have that. But I suppose with my kids, you know, the biggest annoyance for me is if any of them have gone away for a weekend or at a festival, you know, and I've tried to text them to see if they're still alive. You know, they'll always sort of say when they get back, we ran out of data, I'm so sorry. And with so many things on your phone now, you know, streaming and FaceTiming friends and stuff like that, it does get sapped up quite quickly. So that's why Sky Mobile have done this fabulous benefit where it lets you keep all your spare data for up to 3 years, which is amazing. And every month, any data that you don't use, you can actually roll it over and gift it to your kids. So I've told Ruby, like, that's one excuse you cannot use because there will always be data there. But it's quite interesting. Also in the survey, it did say that 47% of children, students said that they would check in with their family weekly. So that's quite reassuring to hear as well. And I think it's always, like we said, that nice sort of, you know, familiar voice at the end of the line, or just for that little bit of advice, whether it be what washing detergent to put into the washing machine, or, you know, the silliest little things, to be able to keep in touch with your, you know, your family is really important.
It's obviously one of the reasons that Sky Mobile has actually won both the best pay monthly network and best value pay monthly network by Uswitch over the last recent sort of past, etc. But let's, I mean, clearly, on the one hand, for children who want to be completely independent, that's one excuse gone now. You know, they switch to Sky Mobile, they can't say, we've run out of data, we couldn't possibly reach it, yeah. It's not a case. What other sort of advice would you actually have, Cherie, for parents who are seeing their children off now? I mean, again, right from the start now, it's a big difference that I've noticed, certainly in the 21st century, that more and more parents are actually engaging in the whole journey, really, from the beginning, the open day scenario, right the way through to the end, graduation, and so on. But what are the sort of key words of wisdom that you'd have, Cherie, from people who sort of might think, yeah, well, it's all very good if your mum's Cherie Murphy, but, you know...
No, I think, well, this is a new experience for me. My eldest child, my son, he didn't go off to university, so he's still at home, which I'm quite happy with. That's fine. He's actually his drama course, because he's into drama, is near where we live, so he's able to stay at home, which is great. But I think, you know, this with Ruby leaving home, it's our, you know, our first child to leave home, so it's just as new to me than it is to, you know, other families that are experiencing the same thing. I find really helpful, especially on my social media platforms, you know, if I put something out there about, you know, a worry or something about university, the amount of parents that get in touch with me, it's great. So we have our own little support network, and some will say, you should do this or make sure you do that. So I think it's about communicating and talking with each other and other parents that have been through it as well. Yeah, so I think that's, I'm learning as I go, put it that way.
And in terms of, obviously, Ruby, as I say, heading off, what course is she studying, by the way, just out of interest?
So she's doing media and communications. She hates being in front of the camera or anything like that. She's definitely not like me, but she definitely wants to do something within the media. She did politics for her A-levels and also Spanish, and she did really well in her results. And I was hoping that she might become our next prime minister, but no, I think she's...
No, leaving. Cherie, that's your job. I mean, you know, the bottom line is, we know that, we know this is the case, and that's the important thing. You should actually sort of go from that point of view onwards, pave the way. It's very critical. So let's move on to, where can people find out further information about this Sky Mobile fabulous plan? And indeed, how, if you sort of say, yeah, but I'm with X network, I'm with Y network, how could I possibly connect with Sky Mobile? You can do this, you can. How can they do this?
Well, it's really simple if you are looking to change networks and look at it, because it is such a great deal that they're doing, and it just will work for the family and save you money. All you have to do is go to sky.com, and literally all the information's on there. And like I said, it's super easy. So make sure you have a good look.
Sherry, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self. We've got the two final questions, which certainly as a communications tutor and media soul and Lambda graduate, I need to obviously put to you from that point of view. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yeah, no, it has. Really good. Really good.
That's good. It's customer satisfaction, Sherry. You know, it's an important thing. Smiley face there. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future? Will you be kind enough to return?
Oh, yes, please, if you'll have me.
Cherie Murphy, actress, television presenter, future Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Take care. Bye for now.
Thank you so much.
Well, maybe we're seeing a turning point when it comes to the recycling scenario. Even though a third of British folk worry a great deal about the state of the world being left behind for the next generation, don't worry, the children will take on the responsibility. Three quarters of parents say that their children influence the family's recycling habits at home. And who better to actually address this particular issue in terms of recycling to save the planet than, of course, broadcaster extraordinaire, writer extraordinaire, presenter extraordinaire. He's clearly an extraordinary person. He's Ben Fogle. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well. Thank you for that introduction. I don't know if I am. I don't know if I'm an extraordinary or extraordinaire in any of those areas, but I like to do my bit.
Exactly. And that's the key thing for it. This research by Robinsons has suggested that everybody is doing their bit. I mean, some of these numbers, Ben, 16,380 plastic bottles. That's a lot of plastic bottles being put in the recycling bin. 15,397 cardboard boxes, 12,448 yogurt pots, all put into the recycling bin over their lifespan. A lot of yogurt pots, cardboard boxes and plastic bottles there, Ben.
It's unbelievable. 250,000 items in total in the average Brit's lifetime, which is both really empowering and uplifting that we're making those changes to actually recycle those items, but also slightly worrying that think of how much stuff we're getting through in our lifetime. The amount of packaging is ever increasing. But I've always been very positive. And the statistic that I particularly like from the Robinsons research is that three quarters of Brits say their children influence their recycling. And that certainly happens in our household. I have plenty of failings. I mess up often when it comes to recycling. It's very confusing what can and can't go into the recycling bin. But my children have kind of made it their mission to be in charge. We've got a beautiful poster at home. They've gone online to understand what can and can't be recycled so that we're absolutely clear. And I'll tell you what's really useful about that poster that they've done is that we can now tackle our recycling from the grassroots level, as in when we go to the shops to buy it, because we now know the items that can't be recycled, that are difficult to be recycled, confusing, and we try to abstain from them. So we've kind of made it a challenge to reduce that recycling bag. I'm sure many of us have this where, you know, your recycling bin is constantly filling up. It's now a reverse that our bin of refuse, because we also compost all of our foodstuffs, obviously, our kind of the remaining bag of food waste is minimal now, but our recycling bin is absolutely bulging. So we're now trying to tackle at reducing that still further. And you can do it. You can go into the supermarket and have a look at the products you buy, how many layers of protective packaging, how many layers of protective packaging are on it, and how many layers of aesthetic protection is on it. We've all seen that where you buy a product, you slide it out of the cardboard sleeve. Do we really need that? I don't want to be focus on any individual products here, but we can be better at our consumer habits that can go further to improve our recycling habits.
Even taking the classic line of the banana, which surely is already wrapped in a skin in itself before you actually need to put it into any kind of plastic bag or thing from there. But that's just a minor point. I said earlier in the programme that parents are very difficult to bring into the world. And it does seem as though when it comes to education, two-thirds of parents are insistent that the school is responsible for instilling green values in their children, with just 42% apparently of parents taking the credit themselves. I mean, surely this is a classic case of it's everybody's responsibility to think about this. I mean, we've got clearly the COP conference taking place in November, but you know, those kind of small changes that we can make on the individual level, and you've alluded to some of them already, Ben, it kind of transcends the whole notion of who's responsible for this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think we just need to take self-responsibility as well as this idea, you know, you mentioned COP26 coming up, the big global conference in Glasgow. And there's this idea that we have to get other people, governments, ministers, big brands, companies to make those changes. And of course we do, but we also have the power as consumers and individuals to make our own personal changes. Do you need to do that car journey? Do you need that extra radiator on, the light on? And I know we've been talking about this for many years, but what I say to people is, it's very easy to feel overwhelmed. What difference will it make if I didn't turn that light off when I left the house? What difference does it make if I just get that one bottle? But you just have to think about the scale. Scale it up. Multiply it by 7 billion every time you do it. And don't think about the negatives. Don't think about all the people who aren't making that change. Think about all the people that are. And I think it's all about changing our mindsets from negative to positive. Lots of the narrative on green issues right now have been negative. We've seen it with the press, you know, the terrible forest fires, the flooding, global changes, hurricanes when there shouldn't be hurricanes, bigger hurricanes than usual. It's happening. We know it's happening. But let's rather than dwell on the negatives and the fear, which is quite terrifying for many people of an anxious disposition, let's try and focus on the positives we have been doing and we can do. And I think this Recycling Week and the work being done by Robinsons is testament to that. They've actually set up a great resource. If any of your listeners kind of want to try and make another change or want some ideas, they can go to recyclenow.com, which will give you all sorts of advice on what you can do on a kind of family or personal level. And I think we just need to kind of work together more as a community in a collaborative way.
Indeed, take those small steps and everybody will be extraordinary, just like you, Ben. So there we are. It'll all work together perfectly.
I like what you did.
Well, you know, it brings it neatly around. So two final questions for you, Ben. We like to think of them as our sustainability questions, really. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today, being number one?
Have I had what, sorry?
A reasonably interesting Zoomer with us.
Zoomer with it. I'm not sure what you mean there.
We've been communicating via the medium of Zoom, so therefore I call it a Zoomer. Has it been good for you?
Oh, it's been good. There you go. Do you see what I mean? I'm already the language is changing. I'm struggling to keep up with it. I've had a fantastic Zoomer with you. Yes, very much.
Excellent.
So
you see, back in the day, it might have been a phone link, but now it's a different line of sustainability. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you come back, Ben?
Of course I will. Yes, I'd be delighted to.
Ben Vogel, extraordinary individual. Many thanks indeed, and keep being sustainable. And we do like the birdies that have been tweeting along as well, Ben. That's marvellous.
Good. Thanks. Lovely to chat.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Well, we've spoken about the importance of pets on past programmes, and indeed the notion of separation anxiety for people going back to work and having to leave their pets at home. But there is another additional aspect that's coming across here, which clearly relates to people who are in rented accommodation, because many renters have been part of the more than 3.2 million additional pets who've been brought on board by British folk during the pandemic, with the Dogs Trust itself reporting a 35% increase in calls relating to giving up dogs. Again, that whole notion that the pet is for life, not just for Christmas, springs to mind. But to talk about this whole notion of ownership when you are faced with being in rental property, we're delighted to actually welcome the founder of new tech startup Pet Score to actually hopefully address how she's trying to solve the animal abandonment crisis. That's the wonderful Natasha Horner Early. How are you, Natasha?
Hi, Alex.
Now, Natasha, would you like to just share with us your own tale of your wonderful, faithful friend, Daisy, which kind of led to this company being set up in the first place?
Sure. So I started looking for a rental for Daisy and I in January of this year. And we were looking for 6 months and we were trying to find anything. We applied for houses with gardens, even offered money for a static caravan in order to stay living with Daisy. So it really hammered home to me how hard this problem is for pet owners out there who rent. And that led me to do some research on the problem and realize that actually this could be solved definitely with an online platform. We could definitely improve this situation. So PetScore is a win-win, really. We connect renters with pets to the lettings industry using verified pet references that are gathered online, and we risk score a pet and a pet owner for the lettings industry so that they can see that somebody is very responsible and that their pet is very well behaved.
I mean, that's one of the key things, of course, responsibility. And I think I can understand the disappointed student who might sort of be saddened to know that they can't bring their pet hamster to university because there isn't a pet option within that. But for the point of view of people who, for whatever reason, have chosen to actually be within the renting area, or maybe they haven't chosen to be renting it, it is important to ensure that they don't suddenly have to say, well, it's been a nice time being together with you, Fido, or whomever, but it's time to say farewell.
Absolutely. We don't want pet families separated. And this issue really impacts the biggest people it impacts are under 35. So that's obviously the rent generation. And we really need to solve this for them. It's not fair for them to give up their pets. But at the same time, landlords and letting agents just haven't had a tool in order to basically assess the risk. So we gather a lot of different information on the pet's behaviour and things like their odour, their temperament, how often they're supervised during the day, the night, all the questions that we've gathered from landlord studies on what they'd like to know in order to be able to consider a pet.
I've often been bemused by the amount of times we in the 21st century like to quantify the qualitative. But this does seem as though in many ways, Natasha, what we've got here is a kind of credit score for pet owners, which can be quite useful. I mean, the way in which you collate nuisance, noise, damage, tenant responsibility and so on. Does it work on a Likert scale of 0 to 10 or other sort of other areas that you take into place?
It obviously, every single question that we ask a pet owner, every single question that we ask someone from the lettings industry giving a reference, every single one of those questions has a range of scores. And depending upon which answer you pick on our site, because all the answers are built in, it will total up to your score, very similar to how a risk score works in the credit sector, credit score. So obviously there are levels of risk from very low risk to very high risk. And if you've got a responsible pet owner with their pet, then they're going to get a great score. And the lovely thing about this pet score is that a pet owner can use it not only to secure a long-term rental, but once they've got that pet score up on our system, they can share it with anybody online. And that includes Airbnb hosts, Bookings.com hosts, Expedia. So it's like you can use a pet score to go on a stay vacation and holiday with your pet as well. So our scores work for lots of different situations with the pet. But obviously this crisis, this housing crisis, there are over 5 million renters with pets right now. And in the UK, there's only 120,000 properties that accept pets today. So that's an enormous difference. That's over 4 million people struggling to find a home to live in with their pet. And there simply aren't enough properties available for them.
And given the fact that a third of the millennial age group will actually rent for life if they haven't bought a home by the time they're 40, it's an ongoing challenge, whatever your views about, well, you know, in Europe, renting is the norm and owning your property is the exception. And maybe this is one way of ensuring that, as you said, we don't have not just pet separation anxiety, but actually fully formed pet separation.
Absolutely. At the moment, you'll see not just across the UK, but they're reporting this in the US and Australia, that the shelters, animal shelters, are overflowing because we've come out of lockdown. Eviction bans have been lifted on landlords and suddenly landlords are finding tenants with pets, and shelters are absolutely overwhelmed by the amount of pets that they're getting. And we really need to help solve this situation for them. So I see this as a win-win all round. Pet renters stay twice as long as a normal renter. They're normally very willing and able to compromise on paying a little bit extra in pet rent because they love their pet. And for a landlord, that means it's better business for them. They don't have to pay to refurb and relet that property. And we totaled this up for 2.7 million landlords in the UK. Within a 44-month period, they could be earning an extra 20 billion in revenue from extra rent, pet rent from that pet renter, and without having the costs of re-renting that unit. That's a lot of money, 20 billion. And I think it's an incentive for landlords to be open-minded and try and consider this now, try out the tool. So if a landlord or letting agent sign up, we give them 5 free credits for the first 30 days so they can test drive our service for free and see what they think.
Sounds ideal. Now, Daisy, as you mentioned, is 4 years. So what is that? Effectively 28 years of human life, more or less.
Daisy wouldn't get the top score in a pet score. So it is very, very fair, the pet score. I'm not biased. She wouldn't get the top score.
I was just going to ask in terms of that, but I mean, I presume she would. Isn't she a particular breed?
She's not. She's a mixed breed. So she's a mongrel.
So one of the most intelligent animals then, basically.
Yes, she is. She's very well behaved. But obviously what we want is we want Daisy to gather references in every property that we are in. So as we move properties over time, over years, Daisy has accrued a background, a historic background of references. Now, if somebody else has been renting with their pet for a few years, they can come on and they can gather all those back references to create their pet score. And it really will give them a better advantage for securing a rental. And that's what Pet Score is about, really. We're an impact startup and we want to impact this problem. We want to see more pet families together and in homes longer term.
Which is good for the pet, good for the owner, and as you pointed out, in terms of financially, good for the letting person as well and the landlord.
Well, definitely good for UK society, because Lincoln University did a study a while ago and it showed that the government could save 2.5 billion in reduced GP visits and improve mental health through pets. So,
precisely so, and I'm so delighted you mentioned obviously the University of Lincoln, the home of Siren Radio, which is great stuff. How can people find out, Natasha, about Pet Score, and where should they actually go to find out further details?
Okay, so they can Google us. We are Pets, plural, PetScore.com, and anyone can come on and sign up. So it's completely free service for pet owners. We don't charge them, so they can come on and create a profile of their pet. And for anybody from the lettings industry or any host from Airbnb, they can sign up right now and they'll get 5 free credits for the first month to use, and that's 5 free references basically.
Natasha Homer Early, founder of course of Pet Score, huge thanks, and to yourself and Daisy. Be well, be happy, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Daisy says thank you. Thanks, Alex.
Well, is it the great resignation? Is it a case of that's it, I've had enough, I can take no more, it's just doing my head in? We're talking about, of course, the notion that more than half of workers are less than a month away from burnout, and 15%, perhaps more importantly, are considering moving jobs due to their employer's handling of COVID working. In terms of numbers, apparently this could actually cost UK businesses in excess of £48 billion. And to actually talk us through some of the challenges with respect to this, we're delighted to welcome no less a personage than the head of people at Westfield Health. It's the wonderful Vicky Walker. How are you, Vicky?
Good morning, Alex. Lovely. Thank you for having me on the show.
Excellent. I mean, back in the day, I think it used to be human resources personnel, head of people. That's wonderful. I mean, it's just the title alone suggests that you are queen of all you survey. Was that your decision to actually be head of people, or was it just a case of that's the job description?
Yeah, that's certainly the job description. I think it was head of HR. We've tried to be a little bit more forward thinking and a little bit more friendly with it being head of people.
Exactly. We'll leave other mammalian life forms to one side for the moment and just go for the inclusivity. Okay, let's move on to this particular report, which Westfield have actually produced. Certainly, there are a number of issues in terms of working from home that we've already covered over the last 18 months. But there's also a big issue in terms of people probably, in some instances, against their will, being forced to return back to the office, because the notion of the wonderful networking scenario, all of the other aspects that are put together within that is... It can be different for everybody, really, and not everybody's keen to get back to the office, and not everybody is actually keen to stop remote working. Is that one of the instances we're getting these kind of numbers in terms of people saying, right, that's it. If the company doesn't care for myself, I'm out of here.
Absolutely. You're right, Alex. the three major things people are looking for alternative employment. It's not normally, you know, it's normally about pay, but actually health and well-being and flexible working is right up there. And they're the things that organisations really need to focus their time and energy in to make sure they retain their great employees that they've got.
I mean, it seems fairly self-evident, but could you just explain why mental health concerns are causing such a significant potential employee exodus?
I think given the last 18 months, we've had time as a society to pause and really think about what's important and work out what our priorities are in life. I think our well-being has been brought to the forefront of every conversation. I think it's made people feel very vulnerable and realise how precious their own well-being is. So now it's then turning onto organisations to do their bit.
Yeah, 15% of employees say the reason they're considering changing their job is actually down to the way that their employer handled COVID. Is that a little bit harsh on the employer? Because to a large extent, not just employers and businesses, but actually governments across the globe were pretty much operating in the dark, it would seem, when it comes to what we've been going through.
I agree with you. You know, it was newfound territory for everybody and there wasn't necessarily a one solution that fitted everybody. But I think what the biggest thing organisations perhaps got wrong was they wasn't talking to their colleagues. They weren't having the conversations to find out what their fears were and work with them around trying to either get them back into the office or work with them in terms of what it is that's preventing them from wanting to either go from a fully working from home to a day in the week in the office. So I think we have to start with our people and take time to ask and listen to what colleagues want within organisations. But it's been difficult for everybody. There's not a solution out there that's going to fit everybody and please everybody at this point.
From the number crunching department once again, if you have 16 million people moving jobs, an average cost of hiring someone at £3,000, that's where that cost of over £48 billion tends to come from. Okay, that's one way in which you can extrapolate figures and so on. But what can companies actually do to really prevent employees leaving? Is it a case of, well, if they speak to Westfield Health, we'll be able to ensure that they get the right work-life balance in place?
You know, what I would say is before going out and seeking any resources and any help to get things right, to help prevent people from leaving, talk to your people first. It's the most simple solution I'm going to give, and it sounds very easy, but actually talk to your people. And I think, you know, 83% would change their mind if their employer had those conversations and were able to work with them around their flexibility and about their well-being. But we have some fantastic resources that we can help in terms of creating happier, healthier workforces through well-being solutions.
Certainly, when one looks at the balance between employee and employer, it's fair to say that there are many companies, many firms, many organisations that tend to score higher than others. And if one's being very sceptical, you might well say that in some instances, you actually are looking at an employer for maybe some of your employees to actually head off into the wild blue yonder. But it can backfire. So if I was to ask you, as I'm going to, what is the best way to actually start the dialogue between employees and employers, whether it's in the public sector or the private sector, to actually ensure that the workforce is happy and contented and that morale is high? What are the first steps or employers should actually take?
I think find out where your starting ground is. So where is your baseline data? How happy are they as is where they're at now? You can do that via surveys. You can do it by anecdotal feedback, ensuring managers feel equipped to have those conversations because they can be daunting too. But have that baseline data to see where you're at and what is it they would want in terms of interventions being put in place within the organisation to help them feel more supported around their well-being and around their flexibility.
And presumably also acknowledging and maybe praising work that has been carried out during the pandemic by employees who've been working very hard, and maybe their employer has been too concerned about filling in various bureaucratic areas that they have even forgotten to actually thank their employees for doing work during the actual session itself. That might help as well, perhaps.
I mean, recognition goes such a long way, doesn't it, Alex? Being thanked for something that you do goes such a long way. And I think it's very simple again, but often we forget because we're too busy working through the email inbox or too busy attending meetings to just pause and reflect with what has been achieved during this last 18 months. And often people working from home have been said to be more productive than when they've been in the office, because there is that blurred of sort of work and home boundaries too. So absolutely, recognising and saying thank you goes such a long way, and it shouldn't definitely be underestimated.
Westfieldhealth.com, would that be the best place to go to find out further details about the survey and the information as well?
It certainly would, Alex. There's some great free resources on there for HR managers and managers and individuals. So yeah, definitely head over to westfieldhealth.com.
Exactly. Vicky Walker, Head of People at Westfield Health. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and be well.
I think you do.